And, you know, I never wanted to write a book, although I had been asked a number of times. Once I got famous, and especially once MASH started, people would say, oh, you want to write a book? And I knew what they meant. They wanted me to write a show business memoir in which I told about all the jobs I'd had. And that doesn't interest me, except insofar as they throw light on something more personal, something more interesting, you know, something a little more and maybe even universal. You know, I think it's true that if you can tell a personal story in a truthful way, in a way that really captures it, it can get to be a little universal. And I was interested in doing a piece of writing and not in revealing things about a celebrity, you know, in this case me. There is stuff about my work life in it, but it's really only insofar as it throws light on the real story, which is the story of this kid who has this bizarre beginning. I mean, I had a very strange life, and as I grew up, I had to learn how to become a person and how to live spontaneously. I wanted to live spontaneously, and the beginnings weren't like that. So anything that played into that was part of the story.
When you say spontaneous, I would think growing up around vaudeville would be wonderfully spontaneous.
Well, in many ways it was. I mean, in many ways my life was a little too spontaneous. I mean, from the time I was born until I was about three or four, I was in the wings watching burlesque, you know, naked ladies dancing and burlesque comics and going out to have beers with the comics at the age of three, things like that. That may be slightly too spontaneous, you know. And my poor mother was psychotic, so life was very uncertain to the extent that the spontaneous life is uncertain. Mine was way uncertain with my mother because I never knew when I was hearing from her something about reality or something that was skewed by her psychosis. She was schizophrenic and paranoid, thought I was trying to kill her a good deal of the time. And when I wasn't trying to kill her, she thought other people were trying to kill her. So I needed to be able to cope with uncertainty. I think my life with her made me a little wary of uncertainty. And I had to learn how to welcome it, how to accept it, how to surf it in a way. It wasn't helpful to me to deal with uncertainty by getting more rigid or trying to hold back change. And the title of the book, Never Have Your Dog Stuffed, that's really what it means. The biggest lesson I've learned probably is to let go and not try to hold things in place. When an idea is no longer useful, I try to let it go. When people die, I try to let them go. Not that you don't mourn them, but when my dog died and we stuffed him, that was not a way of holding on to him. He didn't stay around any longer because he was stuffed.
I know you used that phrase later in the book when you were talking about a certain, I forget exactly which acting job, but it was a character you were trying to find, and you said you had to learn to stop stuffing the dog.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I had to learn it in many instances. And, you know, I'll give you an example of how it really came home to me that was a good image for many of the things I learned in my life. When this book came out in hardcover last year, I was in a bookstore signing books, and a woman came up to me and said, I'm your fourth cousin, and I have an envelope with some family photos in it you might like. And so I opened it up, and the first picture I saw was a picture of my father with his arms around my dog, the real dog, while he was alive, not the stuffed one.
Not the stuffed one, yeah.
Well, it was astonishing to me because I didn't recognize the dog. I'd have no memory of him looking that way, the way he does in the picture. And the reason for that is that when we got the dog home from the taxidermist, he had been given this horrifying expression on his face by the taxidermist. He scared people. They were afraid to come into the living room. He didn't look like the real dog, but that stuffed animal had replaced in my memory the real dog. So it was perfect proof that stuffing him rather than helping me keep him around, it obliterated the real dog. And in a way, you know, a picture, a photograph is another way of stuffing a dog, but it was a lot less detrimental to my memory than the stuffed animal was. And for instance, when we did MASH, that was, in a way, stuffing the experience of all of those real people who had MASH. But we tried to be so, we tried to, through an act of imagination, make it lively, make it as close as we could to real life events. But now that the last MASH unit has been decommissioned, there are no more people going through MASH units. Our show, the movie, the book, they're going to be how people remember MASH units. And that may actually obliterate the real memories of people who really went through MASH units. I hope we came close enough through our imaginations not to stuff them. You know, I mean, and right. Imagination, I think, is the key. That can allow you sometimes to go back to the past and see it in some version close to what it might have been instead of some pale imitation of it.
But, you know, people will say that's what theater is, that it's always an imitation. It can never be. You try to get as close to the truth as you can as an actor,
yeah.
But you're never going to actually do it because it is a representation of a specific emotion or situation.
See, that's why I value spontaneity, because if you just try to imitate the situation or imitate nature, it's flat, I think. But if you add imagination and spontaneity, if you come to life in some way with regard to the thing that you're thinking about, the thing you're trying to bring to life, and then it becomes more than a representation. It takes on a new life, takes on a life of its own. If you're lucky and if you've researched it, if you've tried to enter into it, but not just into the details of it to represent the outside of it, but to somehow get inside it, to somehow get what you might call the soul of it, you'll make it live, maybe not in the same way, and surely not in the same way it lived before. But the life it has can have some of the same power that it had when it had life.
Yeah, you talk about that in the book about finding the character of Hawkeye Pierce through the boots. Mm. You know, that was a key thing to find that the soul of that particular
yeah,
character.
Through the soul of the shoes.
Through the soul of the shoes, yeah.
So a lot of actors find the character through the shoes. They put on the shoes. There's a funny story, an old story about a guy playing Lincoln who went to an actor's club for lunch every day while he was rehearsing, and there was an older actor watching him each day from another table, and he came in, the young guy came in the first day wearing the shoes that Lincoln would have worn. The next day he was wearing the long skinny pants, the next day a frock coat, and finally came in with a stovepipe hat and a beard. And the older actor said, "That young man won't be satisfied until someone shoots him." but you do get the idea from the trapping sometimes.
So how did you find, what was it about the boots that let you into him, into that character?
Well, they had been worn by a real soldier, and they were well worn. And there was something about the way they felt on my feet that made me know I was in the Army. They didn't really tell me I was Hawkeye. That was harder. I really didn't have any idea how I was going to play that part, even after 10 days of rehearsal. And on the first day of shooting, the first shot was just me walking out of a door in that aluminum building that was on the compound. And I had to just walk across the dirt compound. And there were a lot of extras there playing nurses and stuff. And I thought, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to be this guy. And all I had to do was walk across the thing. So I'm listening, and they're saying, quiet on the set, you know, and I hear the clapperboard, and I'm still thinking, I don't know how to be this guy. And then they call action, and I think, you know what? You got to just jump into this. There's no time to think about this. And I opened the door, and I walked out, and I see a nurse coming toward me. So I just reached out and grabbed her around the waist, and then she responded, and she patted me on the cheek and said hello. I don't know. So I thought to myself, you know, that wasn't so hard. I can be Hawkeye. You know, you never know where you're going to find it. You just they used to say in improvising, reach into the dark and pull out an answer. And sometimes that's the best way. If you do it too logically, sometimes it takes forever and you never get there. You get stuck in the logic, which doesn't mean that you shouldn't be logical. I think there's hardly anything more logical than putting on a play. Everything has to make sense. But sometimes the things that make sense after the fact, after you make some imaginative leaps.
Yeah, you talk a lot about improvisation and how important it is. And I think one of the things that's important about improvisation is that it's based in trust and it's based in logic. That it's not just leaping off the cliff and having no idea what's at the bottom.
No. In fact, I think that's a mistake that we all make as amateurs and as beginners in theater work. The idea that you need to abandon yourself to the character is, or to the scene, not usually a good idea, because you're not abandoning means that you're giving up who you are and where you are and what you're going through, when in fact what you're actually going through is some of the great raw material for performing. If it's hot, if you're thinking about other things, if your stomach is uncomfortable, all of those things are really happening. And to try to ignore what's really happening is not you're not tilling the field in front of you. You can only till the field you got. And out of that you can find the situation, the scene. Abandoning yourself often leads to tearing a passion to tatters, I think, the old 19th century expression.
Yeah, chewing the scenery.
Yeah, or chewing the scenery. Yeah,
trying to find the truth in it from the outside.
In fact, you know, when people are at their most emotional, very often, and at their most intense, they're very calm about it on the outside. They're very focused. And people don't say, stick them up. They got a gun in their hands. They don't have to do that. They say, stick them up. You know, they really mean it. Yeah. Really meaning it is the trick to me.
The acting school that you went through, which was growing up in vaudeville and doing all of that, is not what we consider a standard acting training.
Well, it isn't. It isn't. I made the most of it. I never went to formal acting classes. I don't recommend that to anybody else. I don't think it's the right way to do it. It took me extra years to learn how to do what I wanted to do as an actor. But I did have a very, very interesting and unusual education in the theater, because I stood in the wings. And watching from the wings, you learn things, you see things that nobody else can see. When you sit in the audience and watch the actors create an illusion, or when you watch the magician create an illusion. I used to stand in the wings in vaudeville and watch Blackstone. I loved watching Blackstone. I watched him really carefully. I was an amateur magician. I was 10 years old. I used to invent my own tricks. And the audience couldn't see where he hid the pigeons, but I could see, because I was watching from the side. And I could see the way he misdirected them. I saw what he didn't want them to look at, and I saw what he made them look at. And the interplay of the actors when I would watch them, the comics in burlesque, or my father and Sam Levine doing Guys and Dolls on Broadway, I watched that 50 or 100 times. And to see the sweat flying off the actors, to see the energy flow between them, to watch Sam Levine perform the part I can't remember the name of Nathan Detroit, in Guys and Dolls. Every night he did it a little differently. He didn't decide to do it differently. He just wrote it wherever it went. And the laughs came in different places. And that was amazing to me. Because I always thought the laughs, up until that point, I thought the laughs were tied to the funny words in the script, and that the laughs would come at the end of the joke. Well, he didn't play it like it was a joke. He played it like it was an event. And he had a sensational sense of humor. So he found, and the audience found, funny things to laugh at various places in his performance. And he, to him, it was an improvisation, although he was always standing in the same place and saying exactly the same words.
Singing the same songs,
yeah. That's right. You know, people say, how can you do a play night after night? How can you do the same thing over and over again? Well, if you're lucky, you don't do the same thing over and over again. Although you're saying the same words, it's a different dance. It's like saying, how could you already danced once. Why would you want to dance again at this wedding? Well, because every time you dance, it's different, or it ought to be.
Now, do you find that improvisation and learning that it wasn't always the words and the punchline on the page that got the laugh helped you with your writing?
Yeah, I think it did. Also, listening to the audience countless times, acting in plays, telling the audience a story through the characters, I began to hear, in a way, part of my brain was hearing what the audience was hearing. I was hearing them process the logic of the words as they came at them. The interesting thing about theater is you're hearing words, and it really is an interplay of words. Theater, as distinct from film, there's a lot to do with images in film. It's all words in the theater, almost all words. And the order in which you hear these things dictates the way you process the thoughts. And I really kept track of that as I was acting, so that when I would be by myself and writing, I would hear the audience processing it too. And the way the people speak to each other on the page gives the audience an experience in their heads that requires your economy, and it requires your giving it to them in the right sequence so that they can get it. Because they can't go back and reread the paragraph the way you can in a book. To me, writing, I think because of the experiences I've just described to you, I think writing very much is setting up expectations in the reader's mind or the audience's mind, and then either fulfilling them or surprising them. And that's the basis of a joke. You know, you lead somebody down a path, and they think they know what's coming next, but embedded in that is something else that they didn't expect, that is both a surprise and inevitable at the same time. You know, I said something like this in the Woody Allen movie, Crimes and Misdemeanors, and I knew it sounded very self-important, and the guy was a self-important guy.
I was going to say, it fit your character in that.
So yeah. But I actually believe it, and I improvised it. I mean, this was what I was saying, that the basis of Oedipus Rex, the structure of Oedipus Rex, is the structure of the joke. It's the same thing. Who did this terrible thing to Thebes? Oh, my God, it was me. You know, it's a surprise and it's inevitable at the same time.
Which is a great way to think about Oedipus, most people.
Yeah, well, now I've ruined Oedipus for a lot of your audience, I think.
For everybody, yeah. Yeah. Well, did you find, I know you wrote a lot for MASH. You did a lot of the screenplays, and I know you won awards for the writing there. Did you find that's different because you're not dealing with a live audience, or were you still hearing
it? I was still hearing it in my head, yeah. It kind of surprised me at first. Now I don't so much hear that anymore because I'm deeper into it or something. But at first I actually did hear a soundtrack in my head. It was a funny experience. And I was pretty much right. You know, if I'd write something then do it on the stage, there would be the laughs where I thought they'd come.
Even in that film situation where you didn't have that live audience response?
Yeah.
Because I've always thought, and I haven't ever worked on television, but I always thought that would be, for actors and writers coming out of the live theater, that would be a hard adjustment to make because you don't have that immediate response.
Well, you know, that's why they do a lot of shows that are supposed to be comedies, those half-hour shows that are intended to be comedies. They do them in front of an audience so they get the response, the live response from the studio audience. And then they play it for a machine to make sure they get the response. I mean, the fact is a phrase that writers use in the writer's room. Oh, the machine will love this joke.
That's great. Well, that also leads me to a relatively recent live experience that you had doing Arnold Vinnick on the West Wing, where you and Jimmy Smits actually did a live debate.
Yeah, that was one of the most exciting things I've ever done because it brought me back to the days when I started, when I was an improviser. Although this was written and rehearsed, it wasn't improvised. But it felt like an improvisation in many ways because it was so dangerous. We were doing it completely live. And when I say that, I have to say it two or three times so people get it usually. It wasn't live on tape. You know, we didn't do it all the way through while they taped it and then they played it later. While we were doing it, the people were watching it in New York. And then we waited a couple hours and did it again while they watched in California. And they were different shows, different audience in the room with us. And they were screaming and yelling much more on the second show. And it was a whole other experience. And you didn't know if you'd forget your lines and suddenly be in a different part of the play at any point. Or just get to the end and have 10 minutes with nothing to do. You know, I mean, it was just scary enough to be exciting. But by this time, I was so comfortable with uncertainty that it was for me was very exciting, and I really loved it.
It was great to watch because, again, it's something we don't get to see. And my parents remember in the 50s watching live television, and everything was, as you say, nothing was live to tape. It was live.
Yeah, truly live.
And you saw the mistakes, and you saw when things didn't happen. And so the audience in some way felt more – the audience at home, not so much in the studio, felt more a part of things. And I was wondering how you had done that because I was thinking, my God, is this scripted? Is it – how did you rehearse that?
Well, it was tough because they needed Jimmy Smits for another show they were doing while we were rehearsing. And he was constantly being taken out, and he had a long part in the other one, so we had very little time to learn his part. But we rehearsed it like a play. You know, we would spend 6 hours a day or so walking through it and asking a lot of questions and trying to get a real grasp of what we were saying. These are very dense arguments, you know, and sometimes there were arguments that I hadn't seen written up any place. So I really had to ask them a lot of questions about it. I was very, very happy that my character was given really strong arguments to make. I thought the danger would be if one of the characters was just a straw man that could be easily knocked down. I hoped that my character would be just as convincing as his character, and many people felt it was.
I think so. Certainly from my perspective, and you're exactly right, I would be afraid that, you know, because it's from a particular perspective, you know, it's about the Democratic Party, the whole show, that, you know, your character would get short shrift, and it didn't seem like which is why...
That would have been destructive to the country, I think, because it was a popular show. People were looking forward to it. If it looked like just a faked-up chance for the Democrat to look good, it wouldn't have been good.
How did you find Arnold Vinnick as a character?
You know, I don't think about the characters too much as characters. I base everything that I do on what the characters want. I find out what they want and how they intend to get what they want or how they tend to go about getting what they want. And then I try to see how I can want what they want. And in fact, it's more than just wanting what they want. When I get to the point where I feel I deserve to get what this guy wants, really deserve it, whether it's to rule the world or to knock off this liquor store, whatever it is, I deserve it. And when I get to that point, then I lighten up on it a lot. I mean, there's no pressing to make the point. And that's when the acting kind of disappears. So you see, I don't think in terms of what the person is like. To me, that's looking at it from the outside. And I never liked to talk about a character I was playing. People always wanted me to talk about Hawkeye, and I never did. I wouldn't be able to, in fact, because to the extent that I can identify in words what the character is, then I'm stuffing the dog a little bit. I'm encapsulating the character. I'm making it knowable. For me, it has to stay discoverable. Once I know it, it's kind of dead.
Well, that spontaneity that you talk about has
to
be.
Yeah, yeah. Spontaneity means to me to be always finding out more about it. I'm curious about the characters. And I find staying like that gives me a chance to understand more dimensions to the character the longer I play the character. It keeps it from being a one-note experience.
It would have been wonderful had Vinnick won the election in the West Wing. I would have loved to have seen where you took him.
I would love to have seen that, too. But, you know, they knew that the show was going to be over months in advance. But they actually intended, and I didn't know this at the time, they intended for Vinnick to win. around November of last year. And then, unfortunately, John Spencer died. And somehow, I think John Wells felt it was too hard for him to take, that both he had to both deal with the death of John Spencer and the Democrat losing. I think that was too hard for him. I don't know. but it was really good that in thinking that they were going to have Vinnick win, they really got into his life more, and they made him very sympathetic, and they had him be a guy of conflicting interests sometimes. He was a much richer character, I think.
I wanted to ask you about the picture of the characters. I think probably he's a widower. He was a widower, yes?
Yes.
And of the woman, if that was somebody they just gave you, or was that a personal
picture?
Oh, no.
They just introduced me to that woman, and we had our picture taken, and then she was my wife. But then she died, you know.
Yeah.
No, and not in real life.
Yeah.
But, in fact, I said that the prop man on the first day said, here's your wedding ring. I said, no, she's dead. He said, no, they think you should wear a wedding ring. I said, but she's been dead 2 years. So I had to go to the producer and say, are you sure you want to see me wear a wedding ring? Want to confuse everybody? I mean, you only say once in one line of dialogue in the first season, I think, that his wife is dead. And then you see the wedding ring, and then he starts to develop this relationship with his campaign manager. What's going on here? Are you sure you want to do that? And they said, yeah, we want to make that special point that he's... And then I began to realize that she's probably why he's running again, why he wants to run for the presidency, I mean, because she probably was his inspiration to do whatever good he did in public service. And in a way, it was probably to memorialize his relationship with his dead wife, that he's going after the presidency and trying to bring the country together rather than just get elected. And that I started to get the idea. It's funny, you talked about wearing the shoes. Wearing the ring, when I thought about, why do I have to wear this ring? You know, and then I started to justify it in my head and started to think of, how does that have anything to do with what he wants and how he goes about getting what he wants? And I started to see a whole gold mine of stuff in that ring.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about fame. You talk about it in the book.
Yeah.
And did you expect it to affect you as it has?
Well, I didn't know what to expect. Except that I didn't think I was going to like it. My father was very famous when I was growing up. He was a movie star, and then he was a stage and television star. And fame always seemed like an interruption. I mean, I was about 8 or 9 years old, and we were walking down Hollywood Boulevard just shortly after he got famous. And what looked like a 16-year-old girl ran up behind us and punched him in the back and swore at him and ran on. And my parents, I was really upset. I didn't know what was happening. And they said, well, you know, some people have a funny reaction when they see famous people. They don't know what to do. And I thought, I don't want to get famous. What is this?
You're going to hit me.
And people really did have a peculiar reaction when I got famous. It was hard for me to adjust to it. People would grab at me, and television fame it involves a lot of people in the audience, and there's a variety of responses, and most of them tend to pull at you in some way. Either they're physically pulling at you, or they write you letters with intimate details in them about their lives and asking for things. I got a number of letters from people who were thinking of suicide and wanted me to give them a word of wisdom that would save their lives. Well, that's kind of a big task for a television actor. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't sign on for that. I felt guilty that I couldn't think of something to say that I thought would be helpful. And on the first letter, I worked so long on an answer, I realized about a week or 10 days had gone by and the person might have killed themselves already. I mean, I was afraid that I was... not only wasn't coming up with the right words, but they weren't fast enough. So after this happened 2 or 3 times, I actually devised a form letter that didn't sound like a form letter, I hoped. But I could get it out right away to the person. And it even included a number of their local hotline for suicide prevention. And I showed it to a friend who was a psychiatrist and tried to make sure that I was that I was doing no harm, you know.
Right.
But, I mean, that's one of the things that I thought, ironically, fame does for you. Here you are, because you're famous, and you didn't know this was going to be part of it, writing form letters to suicides. You know, I mean, it's a very weird position to find yourself in.
And have you found that now that you've written the book and now it's out in paperback, that people who are either suffering from paranoid schizophrenia or who have relatives write to you and say, what do I do? How do I help my friend?
I don't get that so much. I thought you were going to say, do I find now when people look at my acting, they still want to kill themselves? No, I've gotten much better now. Now they just want to go get drunk for a while.
Right.
But
yeah.
No, I get, on the contrary, I do get some response from people who say, my mother was schizophrenic or my brother is schizophrenic, and I know what you went through. You know, people talk about it more now. When I was a kid, no one talked about it. No one in the whole culture would discuss mental illness. And that made it very difficult for families who had mentally ill people in the family, because you didn't have a strategy you could discuss with somebody. You know, how are we going to handle this? You didn't even just say what this was. It was just that everybody walked around with a heavy expression, because it was hard that day to get through the day.
Well, if you're being accused of
murdering,
wanting to kill your mother.
Yeah.
Speaking of Oedipus. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Or something that was father. Never mind.
So that turns out to be the theme today, right?
Yes. Good. Oedipus.
Yeah.
So was writing the book sort of a way to kind of come to terms with all of that?
No, I know it probably seems like it was, that it would be, but it wasn't. I had come to terms with most of this before I wrote the book. The book was, for me, a chance to write something as well as I could, and I had some really good, I thought, raw material to write about. You know, I had a story that I knew well because I had lived it. The problem was to find out how to organize that, to make it so that it was a relatively simple story. And I didn't put everything in that ever happened to me, because I wanted it to follow a clear line. I'm always guided by the experiences I've had on the stage telling stories to an audience during one evening, where you need a forward motion. You need a main action that the people are following, otherwise you lose them, and that's been my training. So that's probably the way I look at every piece of writing, whether it's a sentence, a paragraph, or a book, or a play, or whatever it is. There were things that happened to me in the course of writing it, but I didn't write it in order to get some kind of solace. It wasn't therapy for me to do it. It was a chance to do, I hoped, a good piece of writing. But the interesting thing was, I did find something out about myself in the course of it, which was that, as interested as I am in science, I'm very, very curious about science, I realized that I really had not spent much time learning about schizophrenia. All these hundreds of scientists I've interviewed on my science show on PBS, I just never learned that much about that mental problem. I think because it was too painful for me. So I thought, well, now I'm writing about this, I got to learn a little more about it. So I started calling up scientists that I had interviewed and reading more about it in Nature and Science. I came across this bit of information that really jolted me. And it was that schizophrenics are affected in a certain part of their brain by a chemical reaction that causes their hallucinations, whether they're oral hallucinations or, in my mother's case, they were visual. She saw the devil in various places. Well, the same part of the brain, it turns out, is affected by a chemical reaction when we have nightmares. So I have had the experiences that my mother had whenever I had a nightmare. We all have nightmares. It's a normal thing. The big difference, of course, is I could wake up from my nightmares and she couldn't. She lived them, and they were a part of her daily life, her waking life, which must have been terrifying for her, because they're terrifying enough for us when we're asleep. And I suddenly understood something about her in a kind of visceral way that I had never understood before in that way. I always intellectually understood what it must be like for her, and that she didn't mean to be ill, you know. But here I had some kind of, I felt like I was a little more tuned into her. And I had the suffered nightmares. You know, you said, well, how hard was it for me to be famous? That for about the first 6 months of this newfound celebrity, when MASH started, I had night terrors. I saw people, I'd wake up and see somebody in the room who wanted to kill me. I don't know, maybe I was tuned in a little too much to my mother.
Yeah.
And then I'd realize that I had been dreaming, but it was one of those waking dreams. That's what I think a night terror is. It has the power of a nightmare for you, but you believe you're awake, or you are awake. I was sitting up in bed, and I still saw the person, you know. But it was all because I had a lot of people pulling at me. A guy shook hands with me once over a dinner table, and he was a strong guy, and involuntarily he pulled me down over the table, and I crashed across his dinner plates. He didn't mean to. It was that when we see people who we've only seen on a screen, we lose a little bit of our control. People speak differently. They drop things they're holding. It's a very interesting thing. I mean, I'd love to know more about it in terms of how the brain works. People always say to me, Carol Burnett has told me, they say it to her. They say this phrase. They come up, I'm coming up to you now. You're famous, okay. And I'm the person coming up to you. You're my biggest fan. It's sort of the other way around what
right.
they mean.
I wonder if it's got something to do with, you know, the idea that here's this person that you've seen in your living room,
yeah.
you know, that you feel somehow that you know who that person is, even though you don't, because you've shared, particularly if the performance that you've given is truthful.
Well, there are people who feel that, and this may be part of what you're saying, there are people who feel that the people you see on the movie screen, they form one category of famous people, but the people you see on television are different because you see them in your living room. That may be. I have a slightly, and this is all just speculation, who knows, but here's the way I look at it. I think there probably is a difference between the two, but one, it has to do with the dark. When you watch television, the lights are on in the room almost always. When you watch a movie, it's on a very big screen that fills your field of vision, and everything else is dark. And I think it's a more potent experience. But I think in both cases, seeing people on the screen involves having them play on a set of neurons in your brain that it may be the same set of neurons that you dream with, or a similar dynamic taking place, whether it's the same set of neurons or not. There's something about the dream experience and the screen experience that I think makes it disorienting when you see somebody step off the screen and have three dimensions and walk toward you. It's not only disorienting, it can be frightening. It's as though they're the living dead or something. How did this happen? It was expressed once to me by a boy who was about six. He saw me in a restaurant, and he just stood and stared at me for a long time. And then he said, how did you get out of the TV? You know, I mean, I think that he said it because he was young enough to say what he thought. But I think maybe that conflicting thought happens in adults, too. It happens to all of us. We're all capable of it. Every one of us probably has somebody who has this power over us because we only experience them in one way. And then when they get three-dimensional on us, it's so disorienting that it changes the way we speak. We drop things. The first time I saw a guy walking down the street who recognized me, an ice cream cone flew out of his hand and did somersaults in the air and landed ice cream down on the pavement. And his wife said, Harry, I don't believe you.
Well, I also wonder, too, if it's got something to do with the fact that they know you as a character. They don't Alan Alda.
Yeah.
They know Hawkeye Pierce, or think they do,
yeah.
or they know Arnold Vinnick, or they know, I forget your character's name in Crimes and Misdemeanors.
So do
but,
I.
Yeah. I just saw it the other night, and I can't remember. But, you know, they know you. So when the flesh and blood person comes towards them.
Lester. I was Lester,
Lester.
Somebody. I
don't, That's I don't right. Know. Yeah. yeah. When the flesh and blood person comes towards them, it... That's the disconnect, too, because
yeah,
they're expecting
yeah.
Hawkeye or they're expecting Arnold.
Well,
Bennett,
it's part
yeah.
of this thing we were talking about before of setting up an expectation and then frustrating it or realizing it. There's an explosion in your mind when an expectation is resolved one way or another. It's why music is written that way. You build up a certain tension and then you resolve the chord. And it's satisfying. It's satisfying almost no matter which way it comes. I always think that in a comedy, people get what they want. And in a tragedy, they get what they deserve. And either way, it's a resolution of the want.
Well, I know I've got to let you go, but I was wondering if you wouldn't mind reading a little something for
us. If I can, I'll probably mess it up. Oh, good. Start at the beginning. I'll read the reviews.
There you go. It's a great book.
This is the best book I ever read by Alan Alda.
Then you can read the About the Author section.
Yeah. yeah. Oh, wait. I didn't know that about
me. Oh, this guy is amazing. Now, here's the very beginning of the book. My mother didn't try to stab my father until I was six, but she must have shown signs of oddness before that. Her detached gaze, the secret smile, something. We were living in a two-room apartment over the dance floor of a nightclub. My father was performing in the show that played below us every night, and we could hear the musical numbers through the floorboards, and we had heard the closing number at midnight. My father should have come back from work hours ago. My mother had asked me to stay up with her. She was lonely. We played Gin Rummy as the band below us played Brazil, and couples danced through the haze of booze and cigarette smoke late into the night. Finally, he came in. She jumped up, furious. "Where have you been?" she screamed. Even at the age of six, I could understand her anger. He worked with half-naked women and came home late. It wasn't crazy to be suspicious. She told him she knew he was sleeping with someone. He denied it. "You are," she screamed. He denied it again, this time impatiently. "You son of a bitch," she said. She picked up a paring knife and lunged at him, trying to plunge it into his face. This was crazy.
Alan Alda, thank you so much for coming in. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.